So this is interview one, part one with Professor Deborah Glassman, as part of the Brand Responsibility Oral and Digital History Project. It's the 19th of November, 2010. My name
is actually the 18th.
It's the 18th. I'm sorry. It's the 18th of November, 2010. My name's Millie Lake.
And I'm Anne Greenleaf, and I'm an interviewer.
If we could just ask you to state your name and title for the record.
Yep, I'm Deborah Glassman. I'm a senior lecturer in the Foster School of Business at the University of Washington.
Okay, thank you so much. So, before we get into the interview, we just wondered if you could, or the substantive questions connected to the Nike CGT settlement process, we wondered if you could just start by telling us a little bit about your role here at the University of Washington, how you came here, and what your main responsibilities are.
Okay, well, as a senior lecturer in the Foster School, I teach undergraduates, MBAs, evening MBAs, and executive MBAs, mostly international finance and global macroeconomics. Mm-hmm. I also have an administrative role, which is why I'm involved in the committee, and that is I'm the faculty director for the Global Business Center, which is housed here at the Foster School. It's a federally funded center through the U.S. Department of Education.
Okay, thank you very much. So, as we understand, you sit on the Advisory Committee for Trademarks and Licensing. Could you tell us how you came to perform that role and what your responsibilities on the committee involve?
I was trying to remember. I briefly served on that committee in its previous incarnation. Mm-hmm. I think it was in the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. And when the committee was revitalized a few years back, I was asked to serve, and I'm not quite sure what the process was behind the scenes, but I assume it was a combination of the fact that I had previously been involved and also that I had this position at the Global Business Center.
Okay, fantastic. So would it be correct to say you had a strong awareness or interest in trademarks and licensing issues before you came to serve on the committee, or is that something that developed afterwards?
Probably more fair to say afterwards. Okay. I had taught some courses related to international trade, so that was mm-hmm. my interest, but not specifically trademarks and licensing.
Okay. Perhaps you could also just tell us a little bit about the process of the Advisory Trademarks and Licensing Committee, how often you meet, what your kind of involvement is, and what your specific responsibilities are.
Mm-hmm. The committee meets roughly once a month, which is actually pretty frequent for a university committee. It is an advisory committee, and our role is to advise the president. Initially, the primary focus was to advise the president on the university's participation, membership in the FLA and or the WRC. What has happened over time is that the committee has been, the committee's scope has broadened as there have been issues related to some of the licensees, mm-hmm. and so the committee has provided advice on other issues related to trademarks and licensing.
Okay, thank you. So, as you know, we're interested in documenting the negotiations between Nike and CGT concerning the factory closures of Hugo and VisionTex in Honduras in January 2009, and particularly in the role of universities as institutional consumers. And we know this was a matter that came before the committee. So we wondered if you could say a little bit about when the specific issue concerning Nike in Honduras first came to your attention. And how you first heard about it?
I certainly heard about it at an ACTO committee meeting, and I believe it was SLAP that had brought it to the attention of the committee. Probably it was first a matter of information, and it was one of those things that it was mentioned and was mentioned again, it was mentioned again, and kind of before you knew it, it was an issue. In the same time frame, I think this is when Angelita Godoy's courses had been doing visits in Central America. And so in addition to the usual channels of information coming to committee through SLAP and through the Trademarks and Licensing Office, there were also students who were doing these projects who were bringing information to the committee and raising, I guess you could say, raising the awareness on campus more generally.
Okay, thank you. So maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the process then leading up to the recommendation that was made by ACTL to President Emmett to put Nike on formal notice.
In any of these cases, there's an information gathering process that comes first, and the committee is not directly in the information stream. We rely on other sources to get information. So we were getting information through WRC, through SLAP, through FLA, you know, however it was available. And we invited Nike representatives to provide information. And I'm trying to remember the timing, whether they came up. I remember they came and visited on a couple of occasions, and I don't remember whether it was specifically, where it was in the timeline. I'm sure the minutes will show that. And as the question that, I think it became clear pretty quickly, the question was terminal pay for the workers, and that the information was these workers had not been paid. So that was pretty clear. What quickly became muddy was the who is responsible question. And there was a lot of discussion about the supply chain, and this was something we had been talking about and trying to educate ourselves about beforehand. The nature of the supply chain in apparel manufacturing and how that matches up or doesn't match up with our code. And I think there's some ambiguity in the code. This actually came up at the meeting yesterday about whether the licensee, Nike in this case, is responsible for actions all the way through the supply chain. And what responsible, in quotes, means. Does responsible mean just to know about it? Does responsible mean to do something about it?
And could you tell us anything about your position on that issue in the meetings or subsequently?
I have to say that early on, maybe for a good two-thirds or three-quarters of the way through the process, I felt that our code was sufficiently ambiguous about the question of who is responsible, that we did not have a legal reason to hold Nike responsible. That's separate from the issue of whether it would have been the right thing to do for Nike to take it upon themselves to go ahead and make sure these workers were paid, as a socially responsible corporation. But whether we had a legal means to hold them to it, it didn't seem to me that we did. Where my views changed in terms of Nike, and I think what led me ultimately to vote to advise the president to put Nike on notice, was that this whole debate about how much product was produced in these factories. And Nike really never varied much at all from their initial position, which was that very little, if any, University of Washington licensed product or collegiate product was produced in the factories. And throughout, we were getting conflicting information. WRC was saying, yes, there was production there. Nike was saying, no, there was not production. Well, maybe there was a little bit of production, but that was well in the past. And that not having that information was obviously a real sticking point. And when it came down to it, part of the code says you have to tell us what's being produced where. Mm-hmm. And it was clear that Nike was not fulfilling that. And if they were not fulfilling that, it really undermined their credibility on some of the other statements that they were making. And that's what really changed my opinion, or maybe solidified my opinion, to say that it ultimately became a lack of trust at that point. If they couldn't tell us what was being produced where, that I didn't feel that we could really trust a statement that they would make about responsibility through the supply chain.
Okay, well, I have a couple of questions on that we might come back to later. Do you want to?
No, you can keep going and I'll just add on whatever.
Okay, sure. Well, I was just going to ask you to talk a little bit more then. I know there was a kind of conflict over whether the contract should be terminated or whether it should be allowed to expire. And I know that wasn't a decision. Well, perhaps you could just talk about a little bit more on about your mm-hmm. position on that. I mean, you've kind of touched mm-hmm. on it already.
Two things. One legal and one about timing. It wasn't clear to me that terminating the contract would make sense, simply because I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that the legal requirements for terminating a contract require you to show something about the contract not being fulfilled, and that was going to be more difficult. Mm-hmm. Simply not renewing the contract would be easier, and it would at that point we could just say, we're not comfortable with your statements about compliance with our code, and therefore we're not renewing the contract. There also was a timing issue, and here I think there was a strong difference of opinion between the SLAP members of the committee and other members of the committee. Other members of the committee said, look, we're only talking about a couple months, a short period of time, and then we can do what's easier and cleaner and accomplishes exactly the same thing, and that is that we can not renew the contract. And the SLAP members said, 2 months or whatever it was, is waiting too long. I always took that to be kind of a generational difference. That, and throughout in the ACTO committee, I'd say that the student members are more impatient to see change happen, and the faculty and staff members are a little bit more patient because maybe we've seen bureaucracies in action and we know things just take time. I should add one more reason why I think actually, and I remember stating this at a meeting, not to unanimous agreement, why I thought that not renewing was preferable to terminating the contract. I thought that the statement that of putting them on notice and saying, if you don't do something, we're not going to renew, would be just as effective from a PR point of view and from an outside pressure point of view as actually terminating the contract, and maybe even more so, because it gave us some leverage. It allowed us to have a time frame in which we could say, do something in this time frame, and if you do, you get the reward, so to speak, of our continued business. And if you don't, then we can tell you exactly what's going to happen, as opposed to just saying, well, we're not happy tomorrow, we've terminated the contract, and we walk away, and at that point we have no leverage.
So on that, could I ask you to perhaps speculate a little bit on why Nike did take this about face to enter into the settlement agreement?
Just speculation. I was surprised. And I think, I've thought about it a bit, and I think there were at least two things that played into it. One, it was clear that there was a good chance that a number of pretty big universities were going to join the movement to either terminate contracts or fail to renew contracts or put Nike on notice. And that would have you know, one university, two universities, that's something Nike could have dealt with. A large number of universities becomes a business problem. I also think, and it's just my personal opinion, that President Emmert taking the position at the NCAA played a role, that Nike being very identified with a lot of aspects of college athletics may have felt, you know, we don't want an enemy leading the NCAA. Maybe enemy's too strong, but you know, we don't want someone who is who we've crossed in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you know whether yeah. that played out, and obviously it would be interesting to have been a fly on the wall and hear their conversations.
Yeah, certainly.
Can I just follow up on that?
Yeah.
Sorry, I know I said I was going to jump in at the end.
No,
But one of the other things that that happened over the process was that then Provost Wise accepted a position on the Nike corporate mm-hmm. board, which was met with some controversy. So there's been some controversy, and then some people speculate that perhaps she had a role in making the settlement come to fruition.
Mm.
So do you want to say anything about that?
I'd be surprised if she did play a role. This is based on no information, just speculation, because I think her approach has been to try to completely separate her role sitting on the Nike board and business having to do with the University of Washington. And I don't know her well, but I've seen her in action a few times, and I get the sense that when she puts her mind to something, she sticks with it. And if she had decided, you know, I'm going to keep my mouth shut on issues related to the University of Washington, I would expect that's what she would do.
Mm-hmm.
Whether Nike perceived that as a factor, mm-hmm. I have no clue.
Yeah. Did you have a position that you would feel comfortable sharing with us about her decision to take the position on the board? Because I know it was met by much controversy and resistance by many of the student groups on campus. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. It's fine if you don't.
Yeah, not about Provost Wise, then Provost Wise in particular, but just in general, I think it's problematic to have university presidents and provosts and other high university officials serving on corporate boards, given the relationships between universities and corporations and the role of universities in society in general. I also recognize, and I'm a little conflicted about it, that it can be very valuable to corporations to have voices in the boardroom that bring other perspectives in. If they're just having a lot of other corporate executives sitting around the table, there would be a lot of groupthink. So I would simply say that this is something that universities nationwide are going to be grappling with in the future.
Thank you. So a little bit earlier you spoke about the possibility of other universities following suit. I wondered if you could elaborate on that at all, if that was something that you knew was likely to happen, or if that was mm-hmm. speculation, and what kind of action you thought would
I believe it was Cornell who had put Nike on notice shortly before the University of Washington did. And I know there were discussions at Wisconsin in the same time frame. There's a lot of talk, as these things were going on, there was a lot of talk about who was a Nike school and who wasn't a Nike school. And maybe that has, it was felt that Nike schools would somehow have more weight if they were objecting if they were putting Nike on notice in terms of their licensing. And that might be true, but I think that in general, the more big name schools, the ones we all recognize, were making these decisions in a very public way, you know, that's the pressure starts to add up. And that was also a strategy from the university point of view. Once universities were becoming concerned about these issues, there was a lot of talk about whether universities could act more in concert. I was a little bit surprised that the critical mass seemed to be only just a small handful of schools, rather than, you know, some people said, if we could get 30 schools, then, you know, we can force Nike to act. We, you know, we didn't have to go that far.
Did you have any contact with other schools during this process, or what was your kind of level of awareness of what other schools were doing or the positions
that's,
they were
I had taking? No personal okay. contact, and the awareness was simply through information that was shared at the ACTO meetings.
To just insert another question on that topic, so information and where people are getting information seems to be one of these crucial things in this project. So one of the things we always ask people is, what were the most important sources of information when you were coming to your own decision making? Mm-hmm. And so you talked about how SLAP brought the issue up in the first place, and then there was sort of a lack of information coming from Nike. But what was useful to you and to the ACTL committee when you were thinking mm-hmm. about what you ought to do?
Well, as members of both FLA and WRC, mm-hmm. information that comes from those organizations, we have deemed to be credible. Information that was coming through, and I'm trying to remember the name of the group, the inter-university group that Margaret works with,
mm-hmm.
I felt was credible, and she shared a lot of that with the committee. Information that Angelina and her students collected, which was consistent with what we were hearing from these other sources,
mm-hmm.
You know, added to that. And if you're hearing the same story again and again, that raises your credibility in all those sources.
So some of the, I know some of the students have speculated that Nike, through the committee's interaction with Nike, that Nike was given a kind of equal seat at the table in terms of information sharing as were the WRC and the FLA, and that was seen to be problematic by some of the students, but I'm not sure of the accuracy of that statement. Is there anything you could share on that?
I'm a little puzzled as to what they might have been referring to. That's other than the regular, the couple of times Nike representatives came and directly spoke to the committee and were available to answer questions, you know, they weren't literally at the table.
Right.
There are ongoing conversations. My understanding is there's ongoing conversations between the Department of Office of Trademarks and Licensing
mm-hmm.
with all of the licensees, and the sharing of information is part of that conversation. But my impression is the kind of information that's being shared is the WRC report says X percent of your production at, you know, this factory was collegiate licensing, and Nike saying, well, our report says that Y percent. That's so, you know, that kind of sharing of information. Here's what we're hearing, what are you hearing? I never got any sense that that Nike was party to anything.
Yeah, no, I think, just to clarify a little mm-hmm. bit, I think the issue of concern was that Nike was presenting its information, and the WRC, as an independent monitoring body, should maybe have, their information was perceived to be more credible by many of the students, and I think there was just a question over who the advisory committee was kind of listening to at various mm-hmm. points in the process.
I have to say, I was finding that the information we got through the WRC more credible.
Right. Okay. That's helpful.
They were doing independent monitoring or mm-hmm. talking to independent monitors. And as I said earlier, Nike had this position that was pretty consistent all along, that seemed to be at odds with the other reports, and also seemed to be, I know it was an important main point, but kind of dodged the issue of responsibility.
Yeah.
So So by saying, well, we were making other stuff at this factory, therefore we're not responsible, was kind of disingenuous to me. If you are producing things and you're saying, well, if we produce this product, we have to adhere to a code, but if we produce this product in the same location, we don't have to adhere to a code, did not seem to me a very responsible position.
Mm-hmm. So I'm conscious of your time. I have a couple of other questions, if you don't mind, very briefly.
Yeah.
We can kind of just skip through them. Unless, do you have anything pressing?
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask two things very briefly. So I know you mentioned yourself that some of the students were very frustrated at the pace at which things were happening, whereas some of the faculty representatives on the committee were more kind of accepting of the time that these things take. And I just wondered if you could comment on whether you were generally kind of satisfied with the process as it unfolded, or whether there were improvements that you think could have been made to speed things up or to arrive at a decision more quickly.
In the grand scheme of things, I think it actually all happened pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Realistically, these kinds of decisions often cannot be made more quickly, and if there had been a lawsuit, we'd still be in, you know, even preparing for trial, not going to trial, mm-hmm. kind of time frame. So other than fixing things in our code so that there's more clarity, and other than all parties investing in a lot better information gathering and disclosure, which would have allowed us to avoid the whole issue of all the arguments about how much was being produced in what factory. I'm not sure we can expect it to unfold much faster.
Okay, thank you. And then just my final question relates to whether or not you think this settlement kind of sets a precedent for the future for Nike, because I know they were kind of careful in their wording of the settlement package not to set a legal precedent, and not to absorb legal responsibility, but I just wondered if you had any thoughts.
I think it sets a big precedent that Nike would ultimately take some responsibility, a financial responsibility, for something that happened down the supply chain. I don't know whether it's a legal precedent, but it sets a behavioral precedent. And part of the precedent is that a certain degree of outside pressure can change Nike's behavior.
Okay, do you have anything to finish with?
I have one last question, maybe. Is that okay? Okay, so I was just going to go back to the issue of termination versus non-renewal of the contract, mm-hmm. and there's sort of, it's a two-part question, I guess. And one is, the first part of the issue seems to be the legal issue, and I was just curious if the committee ever consulted with a lawyer about the possibility that Nike might sue over a termination of the contract.
Not to my recollection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We did have a law student as our graduate representative at the time. We were not asking her legal questions. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if that was the time frame when there was yet another law student who was sitting on the committee, and I can't remember that.
Okay, good to know.
Okay, well, we don't want to keep you too much longer. That was really
thank
helpful.
Thank you. You guys were so organized with your questions. I appreciate that.
I hope so. Yeah. It's been a learning curve, but...